case of, you know, it's morning no longer, United States versus Miguel Lara Anzuarta. Mr. Gutierrez.
May it please the court. Good morning, Judge.
Counsel.
Your Honors, we have an appeal which centers around two very distinct arguments. The first argument is whether the underlying deportation order was insufficient as a matter of law to constitute a lawful conviction under 8 U.S.C. 1326.
Do it before 12.
The second argument is a post-Booker argument, which is really a better law argument, an argument which I'm suggesting the court look at in terms of what is the better law. Is as Almendarez-Torres still a viable law? Can we suggest that after the cases of Jones, which is the federal carjacking statute that has the three levels of higher sentencing, which is to be determined by a court at sentencing, versus whether the increase should be a question for a jury. Now, I'd like to focus on that second argument, which is the supplemental argument that I had made, and that is that in the modern text of the Supreme Court, that it is unconstitutional for the legislature to remove from the jury the assessment of facts that increase the prescribed range of penalties. And that is essentially the same logic and argument in Jones with the federal carjacking statute. And I submit that Almendarez-Torres is essentially dead sub silentio.
Now, Mr. Gutierrez, let me ask you this. If this court were to conclude that this is one of the many cases in which sentencing occurred back when we all thought that the guidelines were mandatory, and now we know they aren't. And if this court were to give a limited Palladino remand to your client and basically say to the district court, take another look at it now that you know it's advisory and go through the whole routine set out in Palladino, isn't that as much as you would get anyway, even if we were to agree with you on Almendarez-Torres? Because I can tell you that although you're certainly more than free to preserve any argument on Almendarez-Torres here that you would like to take further on up, it's not really possible for us to overrule a Supreme Court decision. And given the language in Booker, which says, apart from a prior conviction, et cetera, which we've all taken to be kind of code for referring to Almendarez-Torres, it certainly doesn't look to me like the court's already done that job for us, either in Booker or even in Shepard. So aside from preserving for a possible further attention Almendarez-Torres, what do you need Almendarez-Torres for if you've got a limited Palladino remand?
Well, that's a good question, Judge. But
Stay close to the podium so we get the recording.
That's a good question, Judge, but I'd like to remind the court that when Blakely came down, this court extended Blakely to the federal sentencing guidelines by virtue of Booker, and then Booker was upheld in the Supreme Court. All I'm saying is that perhaps if there was a formal finding saying that the extension in Booker goes further and makes Almendarez-Torres at least the prong, not the whole conviction, but the prong of the statute, which jumps up from a 8 to a 16. And as you said, as purely advisory, I've already preserved it for a Palladino remand, and it really doesn't make that much difference. All I'm asking is that the court perhaps make a little more stronger language as far as the Almendarez-Torres, and maybe I could finish shoveling some dirt on top of that particular case. But
you might need to wait for a case where it really makes a difference. Problem, because we don't write advisory opinions.
Right,
here.
I understand that. And Judge, on a more serious level, I believe is the argument about whether the case shouldn't have been thrown out to begin with. I mean, We have essentially two judges because the statute authorized me to pursue collateral decision in which Judge Hart essentially stated that, with all due respect, Judge Norgel was incorrect in its assessment of the exhaustion requirement. And then he went down a litany of the various issues which essentially were in opposition to one another, even though the case is going forward concurrently.
But you took no appeal from that ruling.
I took no appeal from that ruling because I believed that the part of the ruling which suggests that there was no habeas jurisdiction might best be served by attacking the criminal determination. So, in other words, I didn't feel comfortable attacking both of them at the same time when one of them was more on point to what I was trying to say. So that was a tactical error, or not error. I'm saying it was a tactical decision on my part.
No, that's fine.
But you still have to meet the other standards under 1336.
I still have to meet the other standards, and I think that the analysis of Judge Hart goes a long way toward showing that I did meet that.
But, you know, both you and the government have spent a lot of time talking about the Roque Espinoza decision. And even if we were to agree that Judge Hart was the one who was correct on exhaustion, as Judge Mannion's saying, Roque Espinoza isn't so great for you. I mean, your client didn't preserve these points.
Right. And I distinguish Roque Espinoza specifically in this case insofar as, first of all, I believe that Roque Espinoza was incorrectly decided for the very reason that the system precludes an individual who has, say, exhausted his Board of Immigration appellate rights. At that particular time, it would have been a fiction of law, as I claim in my brief, that he could have then turned around within the time after the Board of Immigration appeal decision comes down. These incarcerated individuals are essentially out-processed in what amounts to secret proceedings. No, they don't tell you when they're going to be taken out. They're just while he was serving his time in custody, he was taken from that institution and put in what was essentially a broad view holding cell, which as soon as the plane is ready to leave, you know, they have 2-3 hours and they're gone. And Roque Espinoza, I don't think that was a similar argument, but my distinction is that Roque Espinoza doesn't take into full account the actual machinations that occur when an individual is incarcerated under a heavy sentence, and then once his Board of Immigration Appeals remedy is exhausted, you know, at that time, all of his attorneys were saying, well, you know, there's no more direct review. There's nothing further we can do. And in Roque Espinoza, it says, well, he could have been in the same shoes as St. Cyr, and I just don't believe that. It's not a civil...
So how did St. Cyr manage to do it?
Well, he was a civil litigant, Judge, and civil litigants, you know, they have access to a lot more. Mm-hmm. He had a paid attorney. He was not incarcerated. He posted bond. He sought avenues of relief. He was able to move around and go from one law firm to another until he reached a reasonable agreement, Judge, for representation. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. Mr. Chapman.
May it please the Court, the District Court properly denied the defendant's motion to dismiss the indictment because the defendant in this case failed to prove any, let alone all, of the three factors that he's required to establish under Section 1326D, excuse me, if he's going to collaterally attack a deportation in a subsequent criminal case. First of all, he failed to prove that he exhausted his administrative remedies because although he did ask for a 212C discretionary relief hearing, he didn't do it on the basis that the change in the law should not have been retroactively applied to him.
But, you know, there's an interesting aspect to the government's argument here because on the one hand, you're saying, hey, this issue was up front and center. The immigration judge was asking him about this. We all knew that it was there. And then on the other hand, you're saying, you know, because, you know, a subpart of his 212C argument didn't until that heading in the eventual paper mention this point. It wasn't exhausted. And it seems to me the purpose of exhaustion is to make sure an issue is addressed in the original tribunal, whatever it may be, here the immigration judge. And surely that purpose is well satisfied here.
Judge, I don't think so. And I don't think so because even though the immigration judge notified the defendant's attorney of the availability of making that argument, the defendant's attorney never turned...
But do you think the immigration judge, if the immigration judge had seriously thought that that there was non-retroactivity, would have proceeded the same way?
No, I think the immigration judge clearly believed that you could not apply the AEDPA retroactively to this defendant. But still, as this court and other courts have indicated, that if a defendant is going to exhaust their administrative remedies, even if it's the defendant claims it to be a futile attempt, they need to do it in order to exhaust. And what we see in this case is the defense attorney on behalf of the defendant apparently conceded or agreed with the immigration judge's conclusion that 212C was not available. Instead, what the defendant did was he proceeded to challenge whether his two crimes were aggravated felonies or not, which of course didn't succeed. And then in front of the Bureau or the Board of Immigration Appeals, what he did was he again indicated that the law prior to the AEDPA should be applied to him, but he raised that in the context of an Equal Protection Clause claim by noting that there was the law violated the Equal Protection Clause. That was the argument.
What about Mr. Gutierrez's suggestion that Roque Espinoza is distinguishable? Even if we thought there was exhaustion and we were talking about whether judicial review was foreclosed.
I completely disagree with his position on that. I think Roque Espinoza is direct authority and is the facts of that case are indistinguishable from the facts in this case, to the extent that the defendant here not only had a full opportunity to be represented by counsel before the immigration judge and the BIA, he was told of the ability to make a St. Cyr type of argument, and he had 87 days between the BIA's final decision affirming the removal order and the time he was actually removed from the country.
So your thought is that even if sometimes people are whisked out of the country on an hour's notice, that wasn't Mr. Lara's situation.
That's exactly right, Judge. There are some cases where a person being removed from the country when he did not have an adequate amount of time to actually seek judicial review of a removal order has been held to constitute a denial of an opportunity for judicial review. But the defendant in this case simply claims that he couldn't file a habeas petition because he was in INS custody. I think that argument makes several assumptions. And in any event, what it doesn't do is it doesn't refer to the record at all. There's absolutely nothing in the record to suggest that while the defendant was in INS custody, he attempted to file a 2241 petition and was physically prevented from doing so by the INS. And so he was given that opportunity. The fact that he may have not had the intelligence or education or training to follow up and attempt that is not the test. The question is whether the defendant was given the opportunity to pursue habeas relief. And in this case, he clearly had that opportunity. In fact, given that he was represented by a lawyer in the immigration proceedings, that would tend to suggest that he could have afforded counsel, or at least his family could have afforded counsel, and he could have had the assistance of a lawyer should he decided to take the role St. Cyr did and pursue habeas relief after his removal order. Finally, the defendant failed to prove that his removal proceedings were fundamentally unfair. In order to establish that, the defendant would have to establish both a due process violation and that there was actual prejudice. All of the circuits that have dealt with this issue have ruled that there is no due process protected property interest in an opportunity for discretionary relief under 212C, with the possible exception of the Ninth Circuit. But as this court, even in Roque Espinoza, indicated that it would be difficult to see how someone could have a due process right to merely an opportunity for discretionary relief. But moreover, the defendant couldn't prove prejudice in any event, because all of or most of the factors line up against him. He has a criminal history. The crimes in this case were particularly brutal. There's a lack of remorse and rehabilitation. He has an inconsistent employment history, no record of community service, etc. So to show prejudice under Espinoza-Farlow, he would have to show that he would have received the discretionary relief that he was seeking, and I don't think the facts in the record and his personal history could allow the district court to reach the conclusion that he would have, in fact, received that relief. So for all of those reasons, we would ask that the defendant's conviction be affirmed. With regard to the defendant's sentence, the government concedes that there's nothing in the record that prevents a limited remand, right, as required by Palladino, to ask the district court whether it would impose a lower sentence than 65 months.
Thank you.
Thanks. Mr. Gutierrez? Do you have anything to add? Okay. All right. Case will be taken under advisement. You were court appointed, is that correct? Yes. I appreciate your taking the assignment and doing good work for your client. That will complete the arguments for today. Court will be in recess until further notice.